Hello again and welcome back. The historic and extraordinary westward expedition of Meriwether Lewis and William Clark from St. Louis to the Pacific has been well documented. Officially named the Corps of Discovery, its historical importance is unquestioned. They returned as heroes. What then? Joining me to talk about the men, the mission, and the aftermath as we continue to observe the city's 250th anniversary is Peter Castor, professor with the Department of History at Washington University. So nice to see you once again.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
I think what we ought to do is just very quickly review the expedition before we talk about what happened afterwards.
Okay. The expedition you can actually review pretty quickly. First of all, 1804 to 1806. There are folks in Virginia who like to claim 1803 because that's when Meriwether Lewis and Thomas Jefferson began planning it. But the expedition went from May 1804 to September 1806, went from St. Louis up the Missouri River across the Continental Divide to the Pacific Ocean and then back.
A remarkable journey in so many different ways.
Absolutely remarkable, not just for covering all that territory, but for doing so without a single death due to violence or injury or accident. There was one death due to appendicitis. That's what historians think was probably the cause, but that the men remained relatively healthy, relatively cohesive, and were able to complete their mission.
A little bit of luck along the way, too. I'm thinking specifically of Sacagawea, if I've pronounced that correctly, and the fact she ran into a relative along the way, which in a situation that could have been disastrous.
Absolutely. Well, good luck, but good luck that serves as a reminder of the fact that the expedition succeeded in large part because of the Indians who they encountered along the way, who provided food and resources and most importantly, gave them directions, told them where to go next.
What, wasn't it her brother who had been kidnapped at some point and she ran into him?
It was her brother. She had actually been kidnapped as a young girl and had then moved through several different Indian groups before sort of winding up in the Mandan villages, which is where it's not so much that she joined the expedition by choice, but rather her husband joined the expedition as an interpreter. The striking thing is not only did she encounter her brother, but Sacagawea proved to be a far more reliable interpreter than her husband did.
Right. How did you pronounce her name?
Well, I pronounce it Sacagawea. This is something that people argue about. The reason many people pronounce it Sacagawea is that William Clark, in his manuscript journals, wrote her name in several different ways. And when it was published, the editor had to choose a spelling. And this was an editor based in Philadelphia. He'd never dealt with Indians, and he chose the spelling with the J. And that's why many people use it to this day. But during your own lifetime, it was probably pronounced either Sacagawea, Sacagawea, something like that.
Something like that. Well, let's bring the story to the point where they came back to where they started. How were they received?
Well, when they returned to St. Louis, I think the first reaction was one of amazement that that Lewis and Clark and the other members of the expedition were still alive. Nobody had heard anything from them in about a year and a half. And then they simply show up in St. Louis. And it was big news in St. Louis, but it was really bigger news nationwide. They proceeded to Washington, D.C. And along the way, there are a series of celebrations and parties. And this all builds up to a big reception in the Capitol that Thomas Jefferson organized, partly to congratulate them. That was honest on his part, but also in an attempt to capitalize on this, to announce to people that he had done the right thing in organizing this expedition, that Lewis and Clark had provided all kinds of useful and vital information for the federal government. So it was big news.
How successful was it in terms of what they were charged with doing?
Well, you know, again, the first great success is that they made it back alive. It was unsuccessful in one very important way. They were supposed to discover a Northwest Passage, a relatively easy water route that would connect the continental interior to the Pacific Ocean, and they found that there was no such thing. So in some ways, that was a success. They had answered a question. The problem was it was not the answer that everyone expected and wanted. Mm-hmm. So it depends on how you look at that. But the other objectives, which were to map out the Western North America. They were extraordinarily successful at that, to establish initial contacts with the native peoples along the way. They were highly successful at that. They informed the president, because they believed it, that those Indians acknowledged the U.S. claim to the West, that those Indians were ready to form an alliance with the U.S., and those claims were in some cases overstated, in some cases completely inaccurate. But from the perspective of Washington, D.C., the expedition looked like it had been a great success.
You mentioned the maps, and we have a caller, Richard, who wants to bring up that issue. Let's bring him into the conversation.
Yes.
Richard, go ahead. Richard? He's apparently preoccupied or something. His question, as I understand it, had to do with the maps that they used in the during the expedition. There were no maps. There couldn't have been maps for them.
There were a few maps of Western North America that they consulted. Their principal job was to create a map, to create one that did not exist, and they did this through a variety of techniques. The most important source of information they had were from the Indians they met, who could describe the landscape for them, and they conducted a series of local surveys, partly based on celestial navigation, partly based on estimation, and then they had to compile all of this. And it's actually one of the most remarkable acts of cartography, because when you test their map against contemporary geospatial data, it stands up pretty well. It's an amazing – in some ways, that's the great achievement. It's certainly the achievement I find the most remarkable after sheer survival.
You know, I read Stephen Ambrose's book, Undaunted Courage, and that was the one thing among many, but one thing that really did stand out was how accurate those maps were that they came back with. Yeah, Richard is with us. Let's see if his question has been answered or what he has in his mind. Go ahead, Richard.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yes, sir. At the Missouri Historical Museum, there is a example of a stable platform for the star shooting device, which is not actually taken by Lewis and Clark. And this is my understanding from the what the museum said, that Lewis went to the University of Pennsylvania before the trip. He talked to the leading professor of astronomy at the University of Pennsylvania, who was also the inventor of the orrery, a celestial device for measurement, and that on the expedition, Lewis did not incorporate the stable platform, which was a big metallic device, nor did he use some of the European measurement devices, which was to have a correct timepiece because of longitude and at the same time measurement of altitude through a pressure device. So my basic question is, in your opinion, did Lewis incorporate the best in navigational devices, which were started in Europe, used at sea, and which were not incorporated for various reasons?
Richard, we've got the point. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a good question. Lewis used a variety of techniques, and you've gotten to them. But the point I'd emphasize is that William Clark was, in fact, the principal cartographer on the expedition. And the techniques he used, first and foremost, were time-honored techniques of landscape surveying, which he knew. He was an experienced surveyor. And he combined that with what people at the time called the newfangled techniques coming from Europe and from American universities. But the most important techniques he used were for land measurement and land drawing were really drawn from, again, these time-honored techniques of landscape surveying.
You had indicated, Peter, that the reception in Washington was something akin to, I guess, a public relations coup of some sort.
You know, I don't want to overstate that. What I would emphasize is that in the years immediately following the Louisiana Purchase, which was in 1803, there was a debate raging in the United States about whether the acquisition of Western territory would be good or bad for the U.S. Could the U.S. govern that land? What was in that land? It was extraordinarily expensive. And was it worth the cost?
Potential.
Yeah, what was its commercial potential? Would the U.S. recoup its expense on this? And would the U.S. be able to govern? And one of the things that Thomas Jefferson needed to do was to really dampen out those remaining concerns, but also justify a broad-reaching campaign of exploration. Lewis and Clark were simply the most famous of a series of explorers that Jefferson had sent into the West. So he wanted to take advantage of it. The comparison people often make is to the first moon landings, and it's an appropriate one. There were a variety of goals, and there were ways that politicians hoped to capitalize on those goals, but that doesn't deny the achievement on its own terms.
How were they rewarded?
They were rewarded. The first thing I would start with is they were not rewarded financially in any striking sense of the term. The most important way in which they were rewarded was with federal patronage. And I don't think Jefferson saw it as a reward. Rather, throughout these years, throughout his time as president, Thomas Jefferson was struggling to identify men who he believed could govern the West, because the West at this time was governed principally by federal appointees, not by elected officials. And he looked to a series of men, mostly from the Virginia gentry, and he thought Lewis and Clark were ideal candidates for these jobs. So in 1807, he selected Meriwether Lewis to be governor of a place called the Louisiana Territory, which I'll need to explain in a moment, and for William Clark to be a general in the militia and an Indian agent. And this was a huge area. The Louisiana Territory didn't include the current state of Louisiana. Rather, it included everything else the U.S. had acquired through the Louisiana Purchase. So it ran from the Louisiana-Arkansas border to the Canadian border, from the Mississippi River to the Rocky Mountains. And, you know, Meriwether Lewis is supposed to be governor of this whole area. The extent of his authority was really, in real terms, was limited pretty much to what we now – to what is now eastern Missouri. But it was an enormously challenging task. So that was a reward for them, and they saw it that way. They were both men who had staked their future on service in the federal government, but it was a very demanding reward.
Mm-hmm. Were they close friends? I had read that they were before the expedition. Did they remain so?
They were – the way I would describe it is their friendship really matures during and after the expedition. They had met as army officers in the 1790s. They were both from the lesser gentry of Virginia, but their personalities were very different. Meriwether Lewis was a hot-headed young officer who some of his superiors thought was bordered on insubordinate, but you know, he's got this strong personality that he took with him on the expedition that in some ways made him an effective leader. William Clark was always this much more measured, more quiet personality. But if nature abhors a vacuum, the two of them complemented each other really well. They clearly became close friends on the expedition. Clark always felt indebted to Lewis for selecting him for the expedition, and Lewis always felt indebted to Clark for Clark's support. And that friendship really took hold. And one of the great examples of that is when William Clark's first son was born, he named him Meriwether Lewis Clark.
Mm-hmm. And that obviously was after the
expedition.
But did they remain in contact?
Oh, they not only remained in contact, they remained close working allies. Mm-hmm. When they returned to St. Louis, when they get these appointments, their task is really to work together because the governor and the Indian agent really had complementary objectives. The principal concerns they had in the territorial government was to make U.S. sovereignty a reality, and that meant getting the local population in St. Louis, the local white population, to embrace their citizenship in the United States. And this was a population that had lived under French and Spanish colonial rule. So suddenly they find themselves Americans. That was one task. The other task was to get Indians to not only accept the U.S. claim to Louisiana, but to acknowledge U.S. authority over the lands on which Indians lived. And this was a task that the two of them really had to engage in together. And they clearly saw each other. They saw one another as each other's closest allies in that project.
Well, they must have been effective at what they were charged with doing.
Well, it depends on who you ask.
Of course.
And it depends on when you ask. Meriwether Lewis had a very troubled term as governor. You know, he's appointed to the job in 1807, took a long time to get to St. Louis, and there were critics who immediately claimed that he was governing ineffectively. Now, William Clark thought he was doing a good job. Other critics did not. William Clark's term as governor, which was from 1813 until Missouri statehood, was more effective. And even though he had critics at that time, he was maintained in office. There were people who thought he was a highly effective territorial governor.
So more than just kind of a figurehead.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. These territorial governors wielded extraordinary powers, if you think about it. They're not beholden to an electorate. They've got to report to a president who is in some cases over 1,000 miles away. And with communication taking weeks at a time, they have to make decisions on their own. And they really did wield extraordinary power during that time.
And they had to deal with presidents who were not their patron.
Absolutely. Well, it starts that way. I mean, Lewis benefited from the fact that Thomas Jefferson was his patron and would really forgive him for anything. But Jefferson's successor, James Madison, really had no relationship with Meriwether Lewis before Lewis became the territorial governor. And he found Lewis to be among his more unreliable and less popular territorial governors. Madison found Clark to be a highly reliable governor, and Madison's successor, James Monroe, felt the same way.
One of the big questions that people ask, and you know what's coming.
I know what's coming.
Yeah, is the death of Meriwether Lewis.
The death of Meriwether Lewis.
Yes.
So let's start by saying people wonder about this because Meriwether Lewis died in 1809, and we'll start there. And there really are two trains of thought about this. Mm-hmm. One is, did he commit suicide or was he murdered? Now, I believe he committed suicide, and the reasons why I think are very important because one of the standard explanations and really the explanation that most people know most often from Stephen Ambrose's book Undaunted Courage is that Lewis suffered from a combination of some form of emotional distress, whether it was clinical depression as we would describe it now or something else is hard to determine. He may have been suffering from some degree of chemical dependency primarily on laudanum, which was an opiate he was taking for a variety of conditions. And I think those mattered. But I think what explains not just what, the suicide, but when, is to situate it in the terms of territorial governance. Lewis's term as territorial governor, from his perspective, looked like it was becoming a disaster. He was facing widespread criticism within the territory of Louisiana. Some vouchers he had filed in with the Secretary of War had been rejected. The president, James Madison, had no particular connection with him. So his public career seemed to be collapsing. And in 1809, when he was traveling to D.C., it was really to defend himself. And my own thinking about this is that it's along the route that he concludes that his public career, which had been so triumphant on the expedition, was now collapsing. And that's the reason for his suicide.
And yet there was some suggestion in Ambrose's book that a highwayman or someone of that type might have confronted him along the way.
There is some there are people who believe that's the case. What's striking to me is that everyone – the small number of firsthand accounts we've got all describe a suicide. And everyone who heard about it, including William Clark, his closest friend – all said, well, of course it's a suicide. Charles Wilson Peel, the Philadelphia scientist and artist, had this great phrase. He said, Governor Lewis has destroyed himself. And by that, he meant he had killed himself. But what he also was alluding to was the notion that I think that Lewis had really destroyed himself publicly in the run-up to then. I think the way to think about it is if it was anybody else, based on the evidence we have, people would say, well, of course it was a suicide.
Right. Well, less than a minute left. They were more or less forgotten for the next 100 years.
Pretty much. Now, not immediately after that, but William Clark remained the leading citizen of St. Louis until his death in 1838. Periodically, Americans have shown real interest in Lewis and Clark. But yes, it's really only in the last generation that people have rediscovered them and learned a lot from them.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating story told fascinatingly by you, Peter Castor. Folks like to hear more about this can do so over the weekend. There's a pretty big deal going on here in town, a conference Friday and Saturday. The St. Louis Metamorphosis, I believe that's
Metromorphosis.
That's
okay.
I'm having my problems today. Metromorphosis. And where is that being held?
That's being held at the JCPenney Center at UMSL.
Uh-huh.
And it's a terrific program on the broad history of St. Louis.
I know that yours is just a part of it. We'll have all the information on that on our website at dlpublicradio.org. Thank you so much. Nice to see you again, and thank you for helping us out on
it's
all
It's a pleasure
this.
To be here.
And for tomorrow, join Steve Potter for Cityscape, and he'll talk with the stars of Stage's St. Louis production of Always Patsy Cline. We'll also hear from the Greater St. Louis Jazz Festival headliner Arturo Sandoval and from a pair of married male dancers with the Alvin Ailey Company, talking about their Dance St. Louis performances this weekend. Monday on St. Louis on the Air on Holocaust Remembrance Day, we'll talk to two brothers who escaped the Warsaw Ghetto as children and survived by spending the last 22 months of the war living under a barn. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Amanda Huntingfort, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.